We're moving closer to the profound view. I thought we might just prepare ourselves for receiving this Dharma gift from Kadampa Geshe Langri Tangpa. Prepare ourselves. So a lot of this tradition would say, in order to receive these very profound teachings, we said earlier, they are not usually just typically available, that you need to be a suitable container, suitable vessel. Yeah. That the teaching is only as effective as the vessel is open, the container is open. So I thought we could just chant the Shunyata mantra a few times as a way to become receptive to what this teaching has to offer. Let's put all papers down, because it's not really about being bookish. It's about approaching directly the very heart of absolute bodhicitta. If it must have a name, which it doesn't really need. This realm of truth we're entering. Om Shabhavashira Sarva Dharmaham Swabhavashuddho Haram. Om Swabhavashira Sarva Dharmaham Swabhavashuddho Haram. For a moment, don't put anything back together again. Just notice who's here. So we're on verse 8. We've had a wonderful journey through 7 verses already. So from the beginning, the first verse setting our resolve for the highest good. In the second verse, the invitation to flip our instinct to cherish self first and just try cherishing others first. Third verse, very rapidly recognizing and addressing disturbing emotions, not being carried away into the enchanting spell of disturbing emotions and where that might take us. And then in the 4th, 5th, and 6th verses, they're all about, yes, even in this situation where we might, in a conventional sense, be very justified to not cherish others, even with ill-natured people, even when someone does me wrong out of envy and insults me, even when I have helped someone and they harm me, even in those situations, to cultivate this relative bodhicitta response where we cherish this being, give them the victory, see them as a spiritual friend, even a spiritual teacher. And then in the 7th verse, the very pithy, in brief, even as we take our in-breath and our out-breath, throughout this life. May we actually be relating towards the suffering that causes beings to act in ways that perpetuate more suffering. And may we be an instrument of extending healing light to calm those threatened responses. Yeah. May we be the ultimate refuge. May we become safe to be around. Yeah. Like true safety. Yeah. So then we come to the 8th verse, which says, in this translation, may none of this practice ever be sullied, tainted, ever be tainted, contaminated, or diluted. May none of this ever be sullied by thoughts of the 8 worldly concerns. May I see all things as illusions and without attachment, gain freedom from bondage. Yeah, with all beings, gain freedom from bondage. It's like better than the best cup of coffee I've ever had. It tastes so good, those verses. And some other translations, one in the Dalai Lama's teachings on this, the translation is, may all this remain undefiled by the stains of the 8 mundane concerns. And may I, recognizing all things as illusion, devoid of clinging, be released from bondage. And in Lama Yeshe's teachings, another translation, undefiled by the stains of the superstitions of the 8 worldly concerns, may I, by perceiving all phenomenon as illusory, be released from the bondage of attachment. May that become true for all of us. So we are coming into, especially with the last 2 lines, Atisha's lineage of the profound view. So the first introduction, Damrati talked about how Atisha had 3 lineages, and one was the profound view. So we're coming right into that. And this way of looking at our human situation that is actually liberating. The very same situation, sometimes it's said samsara and nirvana inseparable. It's not like we go somewhere else, like perhaps our fantasy is where there's no problematic people. We go there and there we find nirvana. No. In this very situation in which samsara appears so vividly, like an illusion, right here is also to be found nirvana. It's nowhere else. It's in the liberation of seeing what's really happening, you know, a deeper, profound view. Getting to the essential truth. And I was reflecting on that. What's essential is what's essential to know, in the sense of this is very practical. Yeah. It's not true in a metaphysical sense so much as it's profoundly true because it's what liberates. It's the kind of truth, a way of seeing, that liberates. So it is essential to know this. Yeah. And it's essential in that it's, well, what's really going on? Yeah. When we're not just caught in the illusion, what is really going on? So the first 2 lines, may none of this ever be sullied or stained or diluted by thoughts of the 8 worldly concerns. So the 8 worldly concerns are that when we are praise, we become elated. Yeah. Praise. Oh. Praise. And then criticism or blame is the other opposite, right? So the winds are also the 8 worldly winds. They blow very strongly. Praise and blame or criticism. And the concern is not to be criticized and being very dejected if we are criticized or blamed. Oh. So from oh to oh. The next one is success and failure. Yes. So we're happy when we're successful, when our finance report shows a positive number, whatever it is. Yeah. Happy when successful and unhappy when there is failure or a mistake, it does not go as we planned. So, success and failure. The next pair is gain and loss. Sometimes this is understood as around material gain and loss. So gain of possessions or wealth, loss of possessions and wealth. I think more broadly, gain and loss. So we're joyful when we get something, we accumulate, and when we lose it, we are saddened. We feel less. Yeah. And the last pair is fame or good reputation and being unrecognized or bad reputation. Good reputation or bad reputation. Sometimes it could also be just feeling unrecognized. Yeah. So we're pleased when we have fame. Very good. And when we are not recognized or have a bad reputation, it concerns us. We become very concerned to change that, how people think of us. You might reflect in the groups in your leadership roles here in Turetna, where you might tend to get more caught, yeah? Where we can fall under the spell of these concerns. In summary, we could say they're about operating in a mode of hope and fear. So a kind of summary is we're hoping for everything on the left column, yes? And we fear loss, we fear criticisms, we fear having a bad reputation. Hope and fear. And you hear many songs of the Maha cities singing about living free of hope and fear, which is I find it's a very attractive proposition. Like, why not? So may none of this bodhisattva practice, this expression of profound compassion for all beings, may none of it be sullied by being preoccupied with this, yes? In a way, we could see this as a distraction. All this is a distraction. It tends to get our attention. There's lots of activity that can go with this, right? And I like the translation that talked about these as superstitions, undefiled by the superstitions of the eight worldly concerns. So superstition is something that doesn't make any sense to follow as a way of life. In a way, it's irrational. Why is it irrational? Because there will always be gain and loss. It will never be a place of true satisfaction or stability. Trying to pursue the eight worldly winds, they're always going to blow in different directions. We can't control samsara. So to try to put so much energy in this activity is irrational. It arises from a misunderstanding of paticca-samuppada, not remembering impermanence, not seeing impermanence. So when we have these thoughts, we can also have doubts about the practice itself. We can approach the practice with this attitude and have doubts or concerns about whether the practice will be successful. Will our bodhisattva intention be successful? Will it work? And we can judge it very unwisely, right? So in the previous verses, it's almost saying, well, if you only do this practice because you think if I help someone, then they won't do me harm, that's actually a misunderstanding for doing the practice. If you have this sullied view, this sullied intention that a gaining mind, that by doing this practice I will gain some kind of certainty, then the practice is really, it won't work for you, actually, because it won't work in these terms, it does not work. Does that make sense? It's not about giving you personal security. It's actually trying to offer something much more, actually. Something better. Yeah, like true happiness, the highest goal. So it's reminding us, in a way, of the first verse. These two verses are reminding us of pure intention. Yes, it's not for personal gain or security. It's the highest good that is more precious than any wish fulfilling joy. By paying attention to not falling into being concerned with these thoughts, we can become more stable in the practice, actually. There's less doubt. We're less swayed. If there is someone out of envy insults me, if we have an unconditional attitude, so we're getting also into unconditional metta. If our metta isn't about, I am loving because I assume that I will get some kind of personal reward, then we begin to access this much more expansive, untiring expression of metta. So this is actually quite tiring. It's quite exhausting trying to do the practice on this basis. Yeah. And unconditional metta, while it may sound like, oh, that could be tiring, it's actually, it's untiring. Yeah. It's unconditional, untiring. So, yes, even when we are good Buddhists, so to speak, good Buddhists, doing our Tonglen practice, unpleasant, even bad things may happen to us. Samsara is endless. So it's not about trying to negotiate on the level of samsara. We're now getting at, if you've seen The Matrix, we're trying to hack through, we're trying to jump to a whole different system. This is one system. It clearly exists. The six realms of existence, we can see it can appear, this way of operating. It's certainly, we can do it. But this teaching is saying there may be a whole other way of living, of existing, that is actually where liberation is to be possible. Along the way, we are contemplating the defects of samsara by doing the previous seven verses. And in our study groups, I think there's been some of that, right? Investigating how, when we approach life with this kind of strategy, this kind of attitude, kind of just brings more and more anxiety. Dukkha, sometimes dukkha is translated as stress. Stress and anxiety in English. So reflecting on the defects of samsara is one way to summarize the whole aspect of the previous verses as a motivation to practice a different way. And when we investigate dukkha, the liberation it leads to is wishlessness, which is a suggestion of what this line, these first two lines are. It's like leading us through the doorway of wishlessness. This is all sorts of wishing for a certain kind of gaining outcome. So there's the liberation of not wishing for any outcome. I'm sure we've tasted this where we just are acting in a generous, connected way. And we don't really have thoughts. For moments, we are free of thoughts of what I will get from this. And it's delightful. And there's probably, if you're like me, you've noticed it seems to go much better. Yeah, there's less me in the way, right? So I'm able to listen better. I'm able to respond better. And there's a sort of playful, flexible quality, responsive quality. So in the shift, right here is a spiritual death practice and a spiritual rebirth. Now, a death of all this way of being, gaining, 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 please, please, gaining, gaining. And the rebirth into this wishlessness. So we have all those descriptions of the Bodhisattva where the work of the Bodhisattva is joyful. I love the description where it's like an elephant going from puddle to puddle. Just, what else? What else would I be doing, yes, other than being fully present with all beings and responding, as Bhante said, with spontaneous, compassionate activity? So then the next two verses, may I see all things as illusions and without attachment gain freedom from bondage. And the other translations, recognizing all things as illusory, perceiving all phenomenon as illusory. So in the previous verses, we began to look at our conditioned response to situations that we may find threatening or difficult or challenging. So we began to investigate our conditioned response and just invite ourselves to do the opposite. Yeah. So the conditioned response is to protect self. And the suggestion is just through action, rather than overthinking it, just try doing something else. So it's a wonderful mode of learning. Just try doing something else. See what happens. Here we're getting actually at a deeper level of how we understand or perceive what's actually happening. There's a person out there that is doing something to someone here. Yeah. Self, other interaction. If we look very closely, and we can do this through meditation, through study, and through investigation, even as situations are unfolding. Mindfulness, right? Dharma vachaya. So there's many ways to do this, and to do this seeing or recognizing. It's rather than relating on the level of all our conditioned perception, all the ways in which we tend to jump to conclusions, interpret, so make something out of what's happening. This is very obvious how this process happens whenever you're trying to actually sort out a conflict. You can actually witness the same situation unfold, but you ask person A that has a strong feeling about it, what happened? And there will be something they have made of it, yes? So it could be that someone just said, pass the salt. Pass the salt, please, at the dinner table. But if I have a feeling that this person does not respect me, or, you know, this has come up through our conditioned relationship, I may hear that person saying, pass the salt. Yeah. And I may hear, the meaning to me may be unfriendliness, yes, or unwillingness to engage. And you may be in this situation as a neutral observer and not see that at all, yes. So we can see in these kinds of situations how a fabrication appears, how the magic show, the illusion of so much that gets elaborated appears. So I think those are good examples, because it's so clear as you try to investigate that actually, well, many things may appear. It's not that they don't appear to those people. But in there, like, is there something objectively solid that we can find and say, this is the thing? So everything is a dynamic process. So when we're in the eight worldly concerns, there's a lot of fabrication. There's a lot of extra. Things can get more complicated when we're in the eight worldly concerns. So in the seeing all things as illusion, we're looking very directly. The Mahakarnika sadhana that we did together has some very good pith instructions from the meditation instruction that you might be getting if you were in the Vajrayana tradition of these verses at the time. You might be getting these kinds of Mahamudra instructions that say from the sadhana, all the root is our own mind, the root of everything that appears to be displaying in this saha world. The root is in our mind. Look at mind's essence. What's really there? We look out at the projections. We get lost in the projections and the magical display. But turn the attention towards the mind itself. What's really there? It says, mind's essence, scan, look. In color, shape, it is not. Nothing solid. You cannot find a color or shape to the mind. It's not. And so one and more, it's void of those as well. There's nothing solid that can be found, not one or many. Through voidness, the unfindability of anything solid, birth, cease or stopping, cease and stay, it's free. So of these illusions, when we look, there's no thing that can even be arising that can be found. Listen to the bird sound even now through the sense of hearing. Look closer, closer, what can be said to be born, staying or ceasing. Where is the sound of the last bird call now? Free, yet clear images cease not. Examining in this way, we can't say that there's nothing. Yet the idea of birdsong is something we construct. Amazing, wondrous, clear images cease not, clear sounds cease not. All constructs still. Can you trust that place where you don't need to make more of it, constructing all constructs still? The still mind essence great without bounds is this. Thus is thus is this. Shinya. Milarepa sang, without existing, they appear. How incredibly amazing. Without existing, they, all phenomenon, internal, external, they appear. How incredibly amazing. This attitude of reverence even, you know, in the Mahakarnika, the still mind essence, still of constructing, the constructing, you know, that has stilled. I'm able to see the mind essence. It's great without bounds. The sense of wonder. Sangharaksha talks about wisdom having this aesthetic quality, like the beauty of our situation, actually. We move from horrified anxiety to this opening. We're invited to the curiosity of how incredibly amazing. So this, I feel like, is the true source of a bodhisattva's untiring love, is this connection and seeing how incredibly amazing. Even if this being is suffering and I can respond, because the appearance is so vivid of the suffering, I can respond vividly. And yet, I don't see this hurt, injured person only. I also see how incredibly amazing. It's amazing being. So out of love, this love, then, I'm tirelessly responsive. Yeah. It's interesting, because if in the early Theravadin teaching, and also in the later Vajrayana teaching, it's when we turn towards the insubstantiality, the impermanence, the attachment just falls away. It's kind of interesting. You don't have to do an extra thing. So the instruction is, if you pay attention to the insubstantiality, the attachment just starts to dissolve. So we must remember the view. However you can remember the view in your daily practice, I would say, at least once a day, can we remember this profound view? At least once a day. Maybe we could think of this as a way to follow through our ordination vows. But ideally, there's shorter and shorter times where we forget this view. Dzogchen Rinpoche used to say, you know, you are the most naked Buddha, the most unconstructed naked Buddha, Samantabhadra, Kuntizampo. On your throne all the time, but you don't necessarily recognize it. So first recognize mind essence, how incredibly amazing this human dignity is of consciousness, of mind creative. Shinya, we are Shinya. First recognize that you are actually this dignified Buddha on your throne. And then never leave your throne. So Dzogchen Rinpoche's pip teaching was, don't fall off your throne. So we could see this maybe like Akshobhya, the Buddha who sees Shinya and is imperturbable, knows who she is, who he is, who they are, and is imperturbable. So ideally, there's a possibility, there really is a possibility of never leaving the view. And this is where view and action can join. So that all our activity is unobstructed expression of what is natural, actually. We don't have to fabricate imagining being a bodhisattva and doing good things. We don't have to we don't have to be that kind of fake. If we came back to our most naked, unconstructed way of being. So there's a kind of a trust and devotion. The expression of that would be this unobstructed, spontaneous, compassionate activity. So may I see all things as illusions, and without attachment, naturally, attachment will dissolve, gain freedom from bondage for all beings.